My father was in the shower when his Newbury call came. I was in a dentist's chair. Apparently, genes do indeed rule our lives. The receptionist told me to call home before leaving. When I did, my 2-year-old, Dana, answered. Then his older brother, Seth, took the phone and spoke the words, "New baby." I paused. I was not aware that my wife and I were planning to have a third child. "You're kidding," I said. Then Becky got on and made a minor adjustment in pronunciation. "You're kidding," I said, and said again and again, and occasionally still say. Within a few hours of that call, I began receiving suggestions for a Newbery speech that would match, in necktie and handkerchief fashion, a book of two-voiced poems about insects. "Turn the amplifier to the echo setting. Release a swarm of cicadas into the room. Sign the temptations to sing behind you, repeating key phrases from your speech." My own first impulse was to begin by quoting, at great length and in learned fashion, from Aristotle's Poetics, Robert Graves' The White Goddess, and various other works I hope to read someday. Discarding that notion, I've decided instead to draw from an anonymous author, a man who gave me a ride hitchhiking 15 years ago in the Berkshires. He was dressed entirely in white, a color, he explained, that would have a calming effect on people in the event of a calamity. This seemed a less than glowing recommendation of his driving habits. Later, however, talking about music, he gave me my epigraph for tonight's talk. "Some people understand the flute," he said. "Some people understand the violin. Some people understand the saxophone. But everybody understands the drum." Fireflies flickering, gleaming, glowing, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2. Of joyful noises, many tributaries, music was the widest. I began taking piano lessons from Miss Dixon when I was 7 years old. Ironically, my mind never mastered eighth notes and quarter notes and the rest of the code for conveying rhythm. My heart, however, lusted after the small plaster busts of the great composers which she presented to worthy students, and so I listened to how she played a piece and duplicated it. I often played duets with her and with a close family friend who had 2 pianos. Upon graduating from elementary school, I determined to put away childish things, specifically piano lessons. In 11th grade, however, I rediscovered classical music. It began with Scheherazade, then Brahms' 4th Symphony, then the Firebird. And one day my father brought home from the library the score of Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet, which we followed with our fingers while the music flew by. I was entranced by the visual beauty of a score and by all that simultaneous activity so carefully worked out by the composer. Writing books held no exotic appeal for me. But writing music, feeling those 25 staves with all manner of intricate goings-on, precisely timing entrances and exits, whispering secrets with a double bass while the listener's ear was fixed on the woodwinds, there was a notion that kept me awake nights. At a time when future writers are usually devouring books, I was racing through the newly appeared record collection in the Santa Monica, California Public Library. Schubert, Chopin, Beethoven, Brahms, I felt like the first miner to hit the gold fields. Like writing, Los Angeles held little lure. Following the laws of the physics of adolescence, having grown up in the southwestern corner of the country, I desired to move as far as possible in a northeasterly direction. After 2 years of college, I rode a bicycle up the coast of Vancouver, took the train across Canada, and settled down in the woods of New Hampshire. One town away, in Henniker, was a college that sponsored a recorder consort. Though I'd brought along no winter coat, no gloves, no scarf, and no long underwear, I had prudently packed my alto recorder, an instrument I'd taken up a few years before. I sat down and learned my quarter notes and eighth notes. I joined the group, the first I'd ever played in, and found myself back in the gold fields. Purcell, Morley, Loyer, Telemann. This time, however, I was making the music. This new role effected a revelation. Playing a piece of music, I discovered, gave far more pleasure than merely listening to it. And playing music with other people was infinitely more enjoyable than playing alone. It was glorious fun, and at its best gave a rapture I've never found elsewhere. The seed for joyful noise was planted. Or rather, one of the seeds. In the 1930s, an Austrian composer, Ernst Toch, had written a work entitled Geographical Fugue. It was composed in the strict style of a fugue, but was meant not to be played, but rather spoken by a chorus. Trinidad, begin the tenors, and the big Mississippi and the town Honolulu and the Lake Titicaca, followed by the altos and the sopranos and the basses. It was a brilliant idea. Back in high school, a friend of mine had heard the piece. As a project for a class on the Bible as literature, he'd written his own biblical fugue, scored for four solo voices and making use of the Bible's rich store of proper names. I was one of the speakers who performed it. That was in the 12th grade, when I was writing what seemed to me to be poetry. By coincidence, an uncanny one, since I only recently heard Geographical Fugue for the first time, I had in my notebook an Ernst Toch-like line, a line I didn't know what to do with. It was Cyprus, Sicily, Corsica, Crete. Next year, for a college music class, I composed my own multi-voice piece. It was written for three voices and called Fruit Mélange. The title was all too apt. It began with Cyprus, Sicily, Corsica, Crete, then wandered on through Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Finner, and Smith, Asian geography, heavenly bodies, bicycles, berries, and sundry other matters. After some exposure to real musicians, I realized that I belonged to a different flock. I also decided that I wasn't meant to teach history, my main subject in college. Writing, however, seemed a possibility, and on the brink of graduation, needing to earn a living, it was time to reach for the possible. It turned out to be the perfect choice. I could continue to scavenge among American history. I was an inveterate trash can searcher as a child, combing the alleys of Santa Monica. I could still loiter in libraries and used bookstores, hunting information on silhouette cutting, binnacle boys, yellow fever, wig making, or serendipitously stumbling on something I wasn't looking for, something that might lead to a future book. Similarly, I found that I could make use of my musical interests. Writing prose has much in common with writing music. From Berlioz and Britten and Company, as much from Twain and Gogol and Dylan Thomas, I learned to seek a form with a pleasing shape, to build in both unity and contrast, to love both entrances and the cadence of closings. Every chapter, every paragraph, every sentence I discovered has an arc to it, like a musical phrase. Every word has both a meaning and a music. I write only a page or so a day. After several books, it dawned on me that this was because I was writing prose that scanned, something that makes for slow progress. The weather vanes of Boston were pointed north, the frigates, the angels, the cocks, the cows, and so below was Mr. Baggett. This first sentence in Saturnalia, the novel that occupied me last year, has three parts, each of which contains four beats. And so below was Mr. Baggett. You could say it and all my prose is written in 4/4 time, though I never let the meter become so obvious as to attract attention. I work out my books in detail before starting, so that most of my writing time is devoted not to sense, but to sound, to rhythm, to the rhyme of so and below, then the pivot to the alliteration with Baggett. This might sound like hard labor to some. 8 hours of this generally leaves me refreshed, not exhausted. The time passes quickly. I'm playing in the vast sandbox of the English language. Writing for me is, in fact, very close to play. As a child, a demonstration of how to string flowers in a chain came as an epiphany. I moved on to building with driftwood at the beach. At Berkeley, I made pine needle houses. In New Hampshire, waiting to catch a ride at the bottom of my road, I used sticks, weeds, cans, whatever was at hand, searching for a way to connect them. Play is usually viewed as among those childish things one does well to put away. I've always remembered flipping through my mother's copy of Minute Sketches of Great Composers. Each page featured a grim-faced portrait, a brief text, and a motto such as the Chopin of the North. It was the entry on the Scarlattis, Alessandro and Domenico, that fascinated me. Seeming to point out the terrible wages of play, their motto read, Serious Father, Frivolous Son. Here was my shameful destiny prefigured, a leather-skinned beach bum building driftwood sculptures, peddling painted rocks for drinks and bars, telling all who would listen that my father was the famous author of children's books. In actuality, frivolity, improvisation, experimentation, play, led me to this august gathering tonight. What can you make out of a handful of sticks? How can you connect a half dozen characters? It's much the same problem, and the same joy. The joy involved in joining both post-to-lintel and hero-to-villain, in rummaging for supplies at the beach or among books, in watching a wall go up or a paragraph. The joy found in making has begotten all my books. After 6 of those books had been written, I took another look at Fruit Mélange and wondered if it might be possible to do a multi-voiced book for children. Birds attracted me as a subject. They'd been my clock hands and calendar in New Hampshire. I would write a suite, beginning with a finch's exultation at dawn and ending with the calling of the owls at night. Here was a chance to cast aside sense, or at least plot and character development, and devote myself almost solely to sound. Berries everywhere, there's berries everywhere, from Fruit Mélange became sparrows everywhere, there's sparrows everywhere. The pieces came quickly and easily. I was in paradise, as close to writing music as I'll ever get. I didn't know whether such a book would be published. All I knew was that I'd never had so much fun writing one. The book was published as I Am Phoenix. I'd no idea what response it would get. One of the first reviews to come in could be summarized in the 3 words, "Shred this book." When I visited schools, however, I found that a reading of a single poem removed the book's arcane aura, and that even the poorest readers wanted to step up and read. Performing poetry, of course, is old, not new, as old as Homer, the revered father of rap music. Meter, rhyme, alliteration, they're all forms of repetition. Something children don't need to be taught to appreciate, having been tutored in the womb by their mother's heartbeats, followed by graduate work in the rocking chair. Performing poetry brings out those repetitions more forcefully than silent reading. As Donald Hall has said, poetry begins in the mouth. Shortly before I Am Phoenix came out, I thought of doing another such collection, but quickly dismissed the idea. Sequels were for Nancy Drew and Rocky. Instead of moving backwards, I would move ahead. I would write a different sort of multi-voice book, one with not just 2 voices, but 12. This became the picture book Rondo and C, published last fall, a book with a room full of narrators, each of whom gives his or her associations evoked by a single piece of music played at a piano recital. Miss Dixon, I hope, would approve. The idea of more 2-voice poems, however, wouldn't leave my head. Though I'd spent many hours watching birds, I was led to insects as a subject through books and serendipity. When I'd taken the train across Canada, I'd run out of reading material in Manitoba. It's a big country. In the Winnipeg train station, I'd bought a book called Beyond Your Doorstep by Hal Borland. In it, he mentioned his marvelous fellow nature writer, Edwin Way Teal. I read several of his books, and many years later, when I happened to notice Teal on the spine of a volume in a used bookstore, it jumped out at me. The book was The Strange Lives of Familiar Insects. Others are touched by destiny at birth or in battle or on mountaintops. With me, the scene always takes place in used bookstores. At the time, I was at work on a novel. As a dessert-like reward for finishing it, I promised myself a try at another 2-voice book on insects. Unfortunately, that novel struck a rock and sank in chapter 4. I certainly wasn't raised to eat dessert before finishing a meal, but what else was I to do? Trying to drive from my mind my broken pact, I started on the poem I'd been itching to write, a requiem for the insects slain by the first frost of fall. But when I put pencil to paper, nothing worked out. Perhaps this was due to the fact that I was using the first lines of the Requiem Mass in Latin, not their English translation. Or perhaps it was a sign from above. I tried the moth's fevered serenade to the porch light. Again, unlike with I Am Phoenix, the words wouldn't come, wouldn't fit, wouldn't rhyme. If this account were rendered as a Gothic novel, a storm would be bearing down at this point. The wind shrieking, "Finish your novel!" The rain striking the windows with a sound remarkably like no sequels. I took the hint. I abandoned the book. I'd never failed to finish one book before, much less 2 in a row. I'm grateful I didn't know at the time how many abandoned books I would shortly claim to my credit. After snatching up the nuggets in my own gold field, the pickings were suddenly scarcer. To avoid repeating myself, I had to tiptoe around all my previous books, as well as those on the horizon. Perhaps after 8 years of writing, it was time to lie fallow, to soak up the rain. Unaware that I was supposed to be lying fallow, I kept myself frantically busy. Various chimerical projects dazzled me, then disappeared. I tinkered with the Requiem and the Serenade over a period of months. Eventually, I got them right, but only after such toil that it seemed clear to me I wasn't meant to continue. I labored to salvage my novel without success. More months passed. I kept opening my file, taking out those two poems, reading them, and putting them back. But like a cricket in the house, they kept chirping to me. They were polished now. I forgot their difficult deliveries and grew fond of them. I couldn't let them go to waste. It would be like throwing good food away. Fall came, a time when I often start a book. Desperate to prove to myself that I could finish one, I set to work, and with much less struggle, wrote the other 12 poems. It was like building a house because you happen to have a nice pair of doors on hand. Insects might seem an unpromising choice of subject to some. The creed "nothing human is alien to me" would seem to exclude the doings of arthropods. I've never found them impossibly foreign, dating from the day, years ago, when I went to retrieve an open gallon of paint and found a wasp, completely enveloped in white, laboring to swim to the side of the can. I don't believe I'll be guilty of anthropomorphism if I allege that the wasp was struggling to live. I happened to be in a deep depression at the time. I found no barrier to identifying with the wasp. Or with any of the other creatures in the book. Though some were chosen purely for their musical possibilities, most struck me as metaphors for myself. Like A. E. Housman, who could tell a line of true poetry by the bristling of his skin, I searched for something, an object, a character, an historical happening, an insect, that produces a similar effect because it embodies my current circumstances. Like the self-absorbed shoemaker's apprentice in Graven Images, I see signs and symbols everywhere. But I write fiction, not autobiography. Just as a snowflake forms around a speck of dust, I build a story for children around that metaphorical center, a story in which my own situation has transformed past recognition. For my loyalty, once I found my idea, is fixed entirely on the snowflake, on the facts of a digger wasp's life, not my own. Sometimes, as with a dream, even I don't understand how the book is related to me. The knowledge often arriving years later, like light traveling from the stars. If insects seemed a strange choice of subject, two voices must seem an even stranger method. This method itself attracted me as a metaphor as much as a form. We all have more than one voice within us. A writer lives off these multiple voices. I recall an interview with John Nichols, who said there were close to 200 characters in his novel, The Milagro Beanfield War, and that every one of them was him. The composer Robert Schumann gave names to his three dominant voices, stormy Florestan, sweet-voiced Eusebius, and the introspective Raro. I think of my own as Eros and Thanatos, characters who inhabit us all. The former writes my comedies of courtship, my fast movements. The latter loves sculptures and silhouettes, lifeless images of the living, and writes all my darker pieces. Both are always present. Both demand their due. I feel that my best books are those they've both had a hand in, the books that embrace both spring and fall. In Joyful Noise, which makes a circuit of the seasons, their authorship is clear, as it is, I notice in retrospect, in that first impelling pair of poems, a love song and a requiem. A book for two voices requires two readers. Reading it is a social, not a solitary pastime. All through my years at home, it was my parents' habit after dinner to retire to the living room, to play a game or two, games my sisters and I often joined. As with geologic eras, those years could be divided into concentration and rummy, early cribbage, chess, double solitaire, late cribbage, and so on. For a time, my mother copied out the cryptogram from the Saturday Review and raced my father in decoding it. I'm sure that those thousands of evenings, that education and the pleasures of being with others, and the joys to be found in joint amusements impossible alone, led in large part to my two-voiced books. One hand can't produce a clap or play a game of checkers. Two can. Synergy. The television, I might add, was in a different room and seldom seemed to be on. A family watching TV together isn't engaged in a cooperative activity. They're each playing solitaire. When I speak of this, people tell me about the entertainments of their own youth. One friend described a small cigar factory in which the workers sang together while they rolled the tobacco leaves, entertaining themselves and the people in the neighborhood who would gather around the open doorway to listen. The sight of anyone doing something, producing something, seems to fascinate us. Think of people watching sports or construction projects. The doer acts, putting a stamp, large or small, on the world. To be the doer oneself, to sing instead of merely listening from the doorway, is an empowering experience. For me, to do one's doing with others, to be one of several hands producing a clap, multiplies the magic. I grew up without brothers in a neighborhood full of girls. Perhaps this explains the lure that groups, small and non-denominational, have had for me. Like many of the children who use your libraries, I also grew up apart from extended family, and without a strong sense of membership in a religion, ethnic group, or community. I wanted to be part of something larger than myself, the very thing that previous generations, builders of the suburbs and the nuclear family, had struggled to be free of. In college, I discovered the Greek myths. Like a newborn duck imprinting on its mother, I decided that the Greeks were my group. I would learn by heart their history and their legends. Their gods would be mine. I would be one of them, and indeed motifs from those myths appear in many of my books. There were, however, very few ancient Greeks around to associate with. I needed a more tangible group, the sort that met on Wednesday nights. I found it at last in the recorder concert. Here were the pleasures of doing, of making, of playing, engaged in with six or eight others. The joys of joining voices from sopranino to bass, of connecting people, of building music, that monument of synergy. Porchlight, hear my plight, I drink your light like nectar, dream of you by day, gaze in your eyes all night, porchlight, bright paradise. I've tried to put those same joys, that same excitement, interplay, spontaneity, partnership, into my books of verbal duets. You've now heard my partial answer to the question, where did you get the idea for joyful noise? Most books probably boast such long lineages. I've actually left out quite a lot. Contradancing, bagel baking, the a cappella group Sweet Honey in the Rock, municipal bands, my shortwave radio, our family printing press, they were all involved too. But I wanted to leave time to thank my cherished editor, Charlotte Zolotow, a lover of flowers, as I am of the birds and insects who visit them. To use the title of one of her own books, Some Things Go Together. I'll always be grateful that she took a chance on I Am Phoenix and Joyful Noise. And my hope is not only that the books will give you and your readers the combined pleasures of poetry, double solitaire, club membership, and a Morley Madrigal. I would like to think as well that this Newbery Medal will lead writers and publishers both to follow their bliss, in Joseph Campbell's phrase, rather than simply the market in deciding what to write and publish. It was bliss, not Writer's Digest or Publisher's Weekly, that led to joyful noise. Conventional wisdom, i.e. arthropod poetry, never goes paperback, gives us only conventional books. I would also like to thank Charlotte's colleague, Laura Geringer, for her editorial help, and Ken Nutt, who goes also by Eric Beddoes, and who provided the captivating artwork for both the two-voiced books. He's a fine artist who deserves his adjective. Both last and first, my gratitude to the members of the Newbery Committee. When the British biologist J.B.S. Haldane was asked for his conception of God, he's said to have replied, "He's inordinately fond of beetles." The same, apparently, can be said of this year's Newbery Committee. Thank you. You understand the drum.